This is Fresh Air. I'm Renee Montaigne. Gospel runs deep in American culture. My guest today is Andrew Ward, whose new book tells the story of the young, newly freed slaves who first introduced African-American spirituals to white audiences. They were known as the Jubilee Singers. The Civil War had just ended when they embarked on a singing tour to raise money for their school in Nashville, now Fisk University. The music the Jubilee Singers brought to concert halls throughout the North turned out to be an eye-opening introduction to black culture, and it helped transform American music. Andrew Ward's book is called Dark Midnight, When I Rise, and a documentary based on the book will be aired next Monday night on PBS. The school treasurer at Fisk was a white missionary from Ohio by the name of George White. He was an amateur musician who had organized the school's choir and decided to take it on tour. The Jubilee Singers refused to perform for segregated audiences, so they headed north, following the route of the old Underground Railroad.
Northern whites, really about the only exposure they'd had, aside from some of the soldiers who'd had encounters with blacks during the campaigns in the South, was with minstrel shows and the sort of dark town cartoon image of African America that you'd get from the old Currier and Ives prints and that sort of thing. So they were really setting off on it was an enormous gamble. The American Missionary Association, which was the sponsor of Fisk University, opposed the tour. So did practically all of the faculty members at Fisk. They were all afraid that they would fall into this caricature of minstrelsy, and that they would just bring embarrassment upon this very serious attempt to educate the freedmen. And when they encountered their first crowds in Cincinnati, Ohio, there were sort of titters and giggles from the audience, even audiences in churches, and many of them people who had subscribed to abolitionist missions during the war. It was astonishing and startling for them to see soberly dressed young men and women, although at first they were dressed really in pretty ragtag fashion, standing up on a stage, and instead of rolling their eyes and playing the banjo and telling jokes, giving very sober renditions, at first of mostly European and popular music. But George White was just totally charmed by the slave songs, the slave hymns that his singers sort of shyly introduced him to. Ella Shepherd, who was the African-American matriarch of the Jubilees, said that these spirituals at first were something they were sort of ashamed of. These were relics of slavery, which was something they wanted to forget. And it was also music that was sacred to their fathers and grandfathers, and that they would shout over these songs. And so they never dreamed of performing them in public. But gradually, White persuaded them to sing them and to continue to collect them along the road. They eventually collected about 100 of these songs. Many of them are songs that we recognize now. There was Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, I suppose, is the classic Negro spiritual, and that was one that Ella Shepherd's mother had taught her. Another was Go Down Moses. Their signature song was extremely simple and really just breathtakingly beautiful hymn called Steal Away. But White gradually convinced them to sing at least a few of these songs, and they began to see that where the audiences were restless, squirming around in their seats, or even laughing at the sight of and sound of African Americans singing European songs, suddenly they were riveted by these sacred, secret hymns of their ancestors, and suddenly grown men who seemed hostile the tears were rolling into their whiskers. And gradually the Europeans' repertoire shrunk down almost to nothing, And they sang almost exclusively spirituals, and it was really on the spirituals that they won their fame.
The current Jubilee singers have a CD that's just out, I gather.
Yes, am I right?
Maybe we should play one of those songs that you've just mentioned, Steal Away, maybe, to give a sense.
Yes, that was their signature song, and they always began their concerts with it, and it was one of their most effective numbers. I think that'd be great.
Singers toured, and their repertoire became transformed, became, as the audiences responded so well, became more spirituals in the main body of the songs that they were singing. At what point did things change for them? Because initially it was quite a hard tour, as you described
in the book. It was a very dismal tour. They had very little money. George White had taken just about all of the money out of Fisk's treasury, so it was do or die. For the first 2 months, they were in rags. There were unseasonable winter storms plucking at them all the way along the way. They were thrown out of hotels or forced to sleep in the outbuildings of sort of flea bag hotels.
That was because, obviously, of segregation, in the North.
Absolutely. It was sort of a random segregation that they were running into. They never quite knew where they stood when they stepped off the train at each town. They then stumbled up to Oberlin College, which had a strong abolitionist tradition, and they were a great success. They performed before a convention of congregational ministers who would then sort of relay the Jubilees north and east until they ended up in New York City. And in New York, they were taken under the wing of the most popular preacher of the day, Henry Ward Beecher, at Plymouth Church in Brooklyn. And in around Christmas time of 1871, they performed before his very prosperous and influential congregation. And they were an immediate smash. Suddenly, every church wanted them to perform. They began to raise thousands of dollars a week, and they were really a phenomenon. They were mobbed in the streets. It's difficult to imagine the sort of impact they had, but they were front page news all over the Northeast. They sang in New England. They went up to Boston. Eventually made their way down to D.C., sang for Ulysses S. Grant, but that was really the springboard.
They ended up performing before Queen Victoria.
Yes, Queen Victoria turned up just a day after their debut in London at the Duke of Argyll's house. Her patronage really opened every door in the kingdom, and they went on to sing for you name it. I mean, just about every prominent Brit of the time attended their concerts. Prince Albert and Prime Minister Gladstone just accepted them with just boyish glee, had them over to his house several times for breakfast, and did them the great honor of serving tea from his own hand. And all of that was used by the singers when they returned to the United States. You would think that maybe that kind of attention would make them more a conservative or make them more cautious in the way they comported themselves. But in fact, they used that fame and that acceptance on the part of the most powerful statesman in the world as a weapon against discrimination in the United States.
My guest is Andrew Ward, the author of Dark Midnight When I Rise, the story of the Jubilee Singers. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Andrew Ward, the author of a new book on the Jubilee Singers. He has also co-written a documentary that will be shown on PBS's The American Experience next Monday. Tell me the story of the Pullman train, the Pullman car.
Well, that's one of the great stories, and this is where I really began to realize the impact that they were having. They sang in Louisville, Kentucky, and it was one of their first forays into the South, or at least the Upper South. And they insisted on singing in front of, as I said, integrated audiences, and they sang before the first integrated audience in Louisville's Library Hall. And they managed to get this rather uneasily integrated audience that consisted of secessionist whites as well as unionists and black people from the Louisville Freedmen community. They protested the fact that though they had bought first-class tickets for the next leg of their trip down to Nashville, railway line had told them they would not be allowed to ride in first-class cars and would have to ride in the smoking cars, which was regarded as a very sort of a disgraceful way to travel back then. They stood up on the stage and they denounced this, and they then sang Get On Board, Little Children, a song that I've sung innocuously as a little boy in school, not understanding its significance. But it was really a song about integrating trains, at least the way they wielded it. And they managed to get this audience of mostly Southerners, many of them secessionists, to rise up to their feet and shout in support of the Jubilee Singers. And as a result of this, it made such a splash that George Pullman announced that from that day forward, he would integrate his Pullman cars, very elegant Pullman cars. And he assigned a Pullman car to them, and they rolled down to Nashville in a Pullman car.
But did that last? I mean, I think not. I think you couldn't. They were segregated in the South right up until.
Well, for 25 years they were integrated officially, and whether in practice they ended up being integrated, I don't know, because you had to get past the station masters, who were often very tough racist thugs, basically, who enforced railroad policy. They continued to encounter segregation on railways and in hotels all the way through their careers, well into the 20th century. But these were significant symbolic gains that they didn't always translate into lasting benefits to the run of African Americans. Was certainly not their fault, but the nation's. But I just don't think any other troop ever appealed more inspiringly to the better angels of America's nature than the Jubilees.
Let's just back up again just momentarily for that song, Get On Board, Little Children. I mean, the song is about the next life, heading for the next life.
Yes, it is.
It's essential,
right. And I think
it's essential message is about that. But the words in the song are what?
The fare is cheap and all can go. The rich and poor are there. No second class on board the train. No difference in the fare. Get on board, children, for there's room for many more.
Now that's heaven. That's heaven in the song.
Yes, that would be heaven in the song, but it was true of the spirituals, though, that they contain many meanings. Frederick Douglass was inspired to run away by the lyrics of a song. And Booker T. Washington remembered that when, as emancipation approached, as the end of the war approached, slaves became much more forward about, or made it much more clear that when they were talking about heaven and deliverance, they were talking about freedom in this world and emancipation. So that spirituals really carried many, many messages simultaneously.
So how did it happen that the spirituals that they sang came to be seen at some point as potentially celebrating helplessness or celebrating weakness?
Yeah.
You know, respected, but sort of enabling white audiences to see the people singing them, and thus, you know, black people as not threatening.
Yeah, well, I think the concert tradition, which the Jubilees began, seemed to some musicians to have been muddled by, I think musically speaking, in the first place, to have been muddled by the intercessions of whites like George White and another director named Theodore Seward, who also directed the Jubilees. And a lot of people looked for purer forms of black music after the craze for spirituals sort of died down. And also, these were the songs of slavery and expressed in some cases a kind of resignation, or at least could be interpreted as expressing a kind of resignation that didn't sit well with later generations of African Americans. Some were embarrassed by these songs, suspected them of perpetuating, as you say, these sort of comforting stereotypes about black people and about slavery. And I think the singing of spirituals still takes more trust on the part of black performers and more understanding on the part of white audiences than we're sometimes able to muster. Nevertheless, if you give the current Jubilee singers, the present student choir, a chance to sing before an audience of almost any description, and I've seen them perform several times, you see something still mysterious happen. Tears flow and heads nod and feet stamp. And it's 135 years since the end of slavery, and perhaps because it'll be another 111 years at least before we will have been free of slavery for as long as we had it, there's still something mysteriously and irresistibly moving about these songs.
Hmm. Just a quick thing, because we don't actually have too much time, but just quickly, in terms of the missionaries, the white the teachers and missionaries who organized the troupe, starting with George White, there was a kind of a dark side to that. I mean, starting with George White, he for one, and right through to the point when they were young adults anyway, into their 20s, called them his children. There was a condescending level to some of
yes,
the ways.
Yes, absolutely. There was, and I think the missionaries' motives were certainly not entirely pure. But I really think it's best to approach George White and the other Northern whites who came south with a certain humility from our perspective, because the ones featured in my story did really a great deal more good than most of the rest of us ever have, and a far greater cost than the rest of us would be willing to pay. They don't come off as well as they'd probably like to in my book, But it's important, I think, to recognize these characters not as archetypes of paternalism and patriarchy, but as individual human beings. And they arrived full of idealistic notions born of reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. And that idealism collided hard with the reality of slavery's legacy, the suffering that they saw. And I won't deny that they were sometimes slow to recognize and respect the autonomy and capacity of the men and women they taught, but they were also generous and empathetic and dedicated and brave.
Well, after having immersed yourself in this music for, I'm guessing, several years now, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering what if we were to go out on a particular one of these spirituals, which one you would have us go out on?
Well, there's one number on the new CD that I think is wonderful, and it's actually it's the same song, although not the same rendition. I wish it were the same rendition that we end the documentary with, and it's "Been Too Busy Praying to My Jesus, Ain't Got Time to Die."
Andrew Ward, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Renee.
Andrew Ward is the author of Dark Midnight When I Rise. A documentary about the Jubilee Singers will air on PBS next Monday. This is the current Jubilee Singers Choir at Fisk University performing Ain't Got Time to Die.
Lord, I keep so busy praising my Jesus.
Keep so busy praising my Jesus. Keep so busy praising my Jesus. Ain't got time to die.
When I'm healing the sick,
I'm praising my Jesus.
When I'm healing the sick,
I'm praising my Jesus.
When I'm healing the sick,
I'm praising my Jesus. Ain't got time to die. Cause it takes all of my time to praise my Jesus. All of my time to praise my Lord. If I don't praise him, the rock's gonna cry out. Glory and honor, glory and honor.
Lord, I keep so busy working for the kingdom.
Keep so busy working for the kingdom. Keep so busy working for the kingdom. Ain't got time to die.
When I'm feeding the poor,
I'm working for the kingdom.
When I'm feeding the poor,
I'm working for the kingdom.
When I'm feeding the poor,
I'm working for the kingdom. Ain't got time to die. Cause it takes all of my time to praise my Jesus. All of my time to praise my Lord. If I don't praise him, the rock's gonna cry out. Glory and honor, glory and honor. Ain't got time to die.
Lord, I keep so busy serving my master.
Keep so busy serving my master. Keep so busy serving my master. Ain't got time to die.
When I'm giving my all.
I'm serving my master.
When I'm giving my all.
I'm serving my master.
When I'm giving my all.
I'm serving my master. Ain't got time to die. Cause it takes all of my time to praise my Jesus. All of my time.